Well done on the hammer dapper. Tonight we're continuing our series on Bible bad guys with Haman. And Haman who, you might ask? Well, Haman appears in the book of Esther. And I can really recommend that you read the whole story because it's brilliant. It's full of details that are not for tonight's sermon, which is going to focus mainly on what Haman did and what it tells us about his character. But before we think about that, you do need a little bit of context. And at this time, the Jews were living in exile in Babylon. They were under the rule of King Xerxes. And our reading began with Xerxes elevating Haman to top dog in the palace pecking order. And he was now second only to the king. And as we heard at the end of our reading, Haman hated the Jews with a vengeance. And he was determined to do everything in his power to bring about their total annihilation. So that's the background. Now a little bit more detail. And it's all in the name. Xerxes honoured Haman the Agagite. And Haman, the name Haman actually is very similar to the Hebrew word for wrath. And over the next few chapters, we discover that Haman was actually boiling with barely suppressed anger towards the Jews. And this anger had very long roots in history, because Haman was actually descended from King Agag, king of Amalek. And that story is told in Exodus 17. The Amalekites first attacked the people of Israel after they had escaped from Egypt and when they were wandering in the desert. And on that occasion, the Israelites defeated them. But scripture actually says at that point, there's going to be more conflict. Expect trouble. And trouble came again and again from the Amalekites. And in 1 Samuel 15, it was King Saul's turn to fight them. But Saul failed to obey God's command. God had said, you've got to destroy them completely. And Saul allowed King Agag to live. And the prophet Samuel said, no, God said, you've got to destroy them completely. And Samuel killed the king. Now, several hundred years later, don't know quite how many, Haman is face to face with a Jew. And as far as he's concerned, it's for him to take revenge. And it's tribal, it's ethnic. And we see in all around the world today, so much strife is based on old tribal and ethnic hatreds and an inability to forgive, an inability to move on, an inability to change, that one tribe is against another tribe, and they may even have forgotten the original story as to why they hate each other, but they don't seem able to move away from this hatred. Well, it's all in a name. Haman's opponent was Mordecai. He was one of the Jewish exiles, and Mordecai was actually of noble estate. His tribe and family were the same tribe and family as Saul's tribe and family. So any Jew reading Esther, the moment they heard that detail, that Saul was an antecedent of Mordecai, they would just know trouble. Trouble's happening. And it doesn't take long for things to hot up. Because remember, Haman was second to the king. And Xerxes commanded that all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt and paid Haman honor. And everyone obeyed except Mordecai. And he might have got away with it, except that he kept on refusing to do it. And his failure to comply with strict palace etiquette was noticed. Although, interestingly enough, it wasn't noticed by Haman. Haman didn't actually notice that Mordecai wasn't bowing down to him. I suppose there were so many hundreds of thousands of people around him bowing down, he probably didn't notice the one chap who was still standing up. But anyway, some royal officials asked Mordecai, why do you disobey the king's command? Day after day. So you can see that this was a kind of running drama of Mordecai refusing to bow down. Day after day, they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. The next thing that happens is that the court officials told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behaviour would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. So there's a bit of kind of court intrigue. It was the kind of palace you felt where there was always a bit of intrigue going on. There was always something kind of rumbling under the surface. And maybe these officials thought, well, actually, Haman's number two, so we need to be on his best side. And actually, maybe he'll reward us for giving him this information. So they tell Haman what's going on. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour, he was enraged. And there's that instant anger. It's like they tell him and he's just exploding with anger. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole of the kingdom of Xerxes. I mean, it's a bit outrageous. It's completely over the top. If someone was analysing Haman today, they might come up with the term egomaniac. An egomaniac is someone who's obsessively preoccupied with himself, follows ungoverned impulses, has delusions of personal greatness, feels a lack of appreciation. Or they might think about the characteristics of narcissism, which include vanity and boasting, intolerance and rage, denial and manipulation, an exaggerated sense of entitlement, a lack of empathy, distortion and shamelessness. And actually, as we find out more about Haman's story, we discover that all these and more appear in Haman's behaviour. When Haman heard that Mordecai was Jewish, the fate of all the Jewish exiles in Babylon was sealed. Haman immediately began to put his plans into place. And he comes to King Xerxes and sort of tells him a story that's kind of a mixture of truth and half-truth. He was a bit of a deceiver, was Haman. He said that there were people in his kingdom whose customs were different to those of all other people. Well, that was probably true. You know, the Jews did come bringing different customs, who did not obey the king's laws. Well, actually, only Mordecai wasn't obeying the law to bow down to Haman. Mordecai wasn't rebelling against the king. He was just not giving Haman any honour. But Haman makes it sound as if there's a whole raft of people spread throughout the whole kingdom who are just ready to explode in insurrection and rebellion. Esther 3:8, it's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, so he's kind of flattering Xerxes to think that actually it's Xerxes who's making the decision. It's Xerxes who's thinking these thoughts. If it pleases the king, let a decree be put in place to destroy them. Now, Haman knew that Xerxes had a habit of acting rather impetuously, especially if he thought there was a whiff of rebellion going on in the royal court. And true to form, the king didn't waste any time weighing up the truth of what Haman was saying. Instead, he handed over his signet ring, authorizing Haman to go ahead. Do with the people as you please. And of course, once Haman had that authority, he didn't waste any time. He fixed a date for the genocide, and the order was sent out throughout the kingdom. And of course, it was stamped with the king's seal, so there was no going back. It was law. It couldn't be changed. And this caused enormous distress among all the Jews, not least Mordecai. And tonight's not the occasion to tell the story of Mordecai's niece Esther, from whom the book is named, except insofar as it relates to Haman. And Esther had been taken into the king's harem, where she'd found favour with Xerxes and she'd been made queen. But Xerxes didn't know that Esther was Jewish, and come to that, Haman didn't know that Esther was Jewish. And Mordecai sent a message to Esther, telling her to go to the king to beg for mercy for her people. And this was extremely risky. Anyone who approached the king without being invited was put to death. And also Esther had to be really careful about how she spoke to the king, because the king had authorized Haman's decree. So any implication that the king might have made a mistake would also result in her death. And finally, the king didn't know that Esther was Jewish. But she could hardly plead for her people without revealing that she was one of them. And how would Xerxes react when he found out? He might think that she was part of a great big Jewish plot against his life, which would again put her at risk of death. So there was a huge danger involved. But Esther's response was to ask Mordecai and the Jews to fast. And then after 3 days, she sort of steeled herself and went to see the king. Unfortunately, Xerxes was in a good mood, and Esther was welcomed, and the king asked her what she wanted. And the court was a terribly public arena. There were people everywhere, and everyone was listening. Everyone was trying to catch what was going on and kind of make the most of it. And it was too public an arena for Esther to have a conversation with the king. So she invited him to come to a private banquet that she had prepared for him, and to bring Haman with him. And it was very rare for anyone other than the king to enter the queen's chamber. So you can imagine Haman, oh wow, he was beside himself with excitement at such an honour. He really thought he'd made it. He'd been invited in to have a banquet with Esther. It never occurred to him that Esther had a completely different scenario in mind. So the king knew that Esther wanted something, and he encouraged her to speak. But Esther sensed that the timing wasn't quite right. So she invites the king, come back tomorrow. Come and eat with me again tomorrow, and again bring Haman with you. So Haman's pride was absolutely bursting. He left the palace. He'd had this amazing meal with Queen Esther and King Xerxes, and he probably thought, I'm the one, you know, I've got it there. And as he goes out, he sees Mordecai at the gates. And again, that anger in him is just sparked. And Haman goes home and he gathers his wife and friends and he boasts to them. Esther 5:11. He boasted about his vast wealth, his many sons. He'd got 10 sons. He boasted about all the different ways that the king had honoured him and how he'd elevated him above all the nobles and officials. I bet that's a great dinner party. Can you imagine being invited to a dinner party where all your host does is boast about how wonderful he is and everything that's happened and how everybody's beneath him? You know, yeah, you kiss my feet. You know, I'm bigger than you. I'm higher. I'm greater. The king's really honoured me. Aren't you glad you've come to dinner to hear me talking like this? And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see the Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that later. But Haman, in a word, was totally unable to enjoy the fortune he had because he felt so insulted by one man not bowing down to him. That is incredibly egocentric. Moreover, he'd surrounded himself with people who were going to flatter him, who were going to pander to his moods, who would agree with him rather than speak the truth. So instead of his friends saying, Haman, you're completely overreacting, his wife and friends came up with this outrageous plan that would solve the problem of Mordecai once and for all. And probably too, his wife and friends were completely fed up of Haman going on and on and on about Mordecai. They thought, oh, for heaven's sake, just do something and get rid of him. And that's exactly what they did. Esther 5:14, have a gallows built 75 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy. You can just sense they're really fed up with him going on and on about this problem, which really wasn't a problem. And it is so over the top when you think about it, because Haman had signed an edict that all the Jews on a particular date were all going to be killed. So Mordecai was going to die anyway when the date came up. So why do this? And why did the gallows have to be quite so big? Well, Haman was making a statement. The height of the gallows reflected the scale of his ego. I'm the one, I am in control, nobody can stand in my way, and this is what's going to happen to anyone who tries. And Mordecai's body would be visible from every direction. Ironically, Haman was building his own gallows, but he didn't know that. Or maybe he would have stopped building them. That night the king couldn't sleep. One commentary I read said maybe he was kept awake by the sound of the carpenters building this enormous gallows, which is rather a nice thought, isn't it? I mean, he could have just not been sleeping anyway, but it's quite a nice thought that just down the road this 75-foot gallows is being put up and there's sawing and there's hammering and banging. So what do people who can't sleep do? Well, they look for a bit of bedtime reading. And Xerxes is quite human in that he asked for somebody to come and read to him. And he said, bring the book of the Chronicles, which was the record book of his reign. And as he's being read to, he discovers that Mordecai had once saved him from an assassination plot. And he asks, what recognition did Mordecai receive for this? He saved my life. Did we do anything? You know, he obviously, there was some kind of thing going on in his memory, and this was obviously God working and sort of alerting Xerxes. And he said, what did we do for Mordecai? He saved my life. What did we do? And the answer was nothing. And just at that moment, which is kind of perfect timing when you think about it, Haman arrives because he wants to ask the king, essentially, for Mordecai's neck. He wants permission to hang Mordecai. And instead the king asks Haman, Esther 6:6, what should be done to the man the king delights to honour? Now Haman's ego was so enormous that he thought the king was talking about him. Who is there, it says in the text, that the king would rather honour than me? My goodness me, such a big head. The expression pride comes before a fall instantly springs to my mind, and actually Haman was about to fall flat on his face, because when the king said, well, what should be done to honour the man the king delights to honour, he comes up with this grandiose plan. He suggests that a royal robe, which the king had worn, be brought together with a horse bearing the royal crest, which the king had ridden. Maybe some of you can see which direction this is going in. And that one of the king's most noble princes should dress the man and lead him through the city streets, proclaiming aloud, this is what should be done for the man the king delights to honour. His imagination had no limits. And actually, looking at what he was asking for, to wear something the king had worn, to ride on the king's horse, to be paraded through the streets, this is the man. It's like he's slightly overreaching himself. I think he's got delusions of even more grandeur than he's already reached. I think he'd quite like to be in charge of the kingdom and not second in command. And then to Haman's consternation, the king turns round, announces that Mordecai is the man he's delighted to honour, and that Haman has to carry out everything that he's proposed. And there's a rather neat verse in Esther 6:10. Do not neglect anything you've suggested. In other words, what a great detailed plan, Haman. Go and get on with it. And Haman couldn't disobey Xerxes, because that would have meant his instant death. He must have been mortified, because everyone knew how much he hated Haman. Haman hated Mordecai. And then he's leading this man through the streets, saying, this is the man the king delights to honour. Whoa, he was humiliated. All this time, you have to remember that Xerxes is completely unaware of Haman's treachery. And, you know, he doesn't know that Esther's Jewish. He doesn't know that actually this edict that Haman has signed will threaten her life, but everything's about to be revealed. No sooner had Haman arrived home than his escort arrived to take him to dinner at the palace. And this time Esther was ready when the king asked her what she wanted, and she told Xerxes that she and her people were about to be annihilated. And the king was appalled that anyone should think of doing such a thing to the queen. And of course, this was the deal, that Haman didn't know that Esther was Jewish. He must have been, oh my goodness, what have I done? So at that point, the king is so angry that he leaves the room. And Haman just falls at Esther's feet and begs for mercy. The bully was really a coward. And it was actually forbidden for anyone to get closer to the queen than a certain number of feet. You had to sort of keep a physical distance between you and the queen. So Xerxes comes back into the room just at the moment that Haman's clinging to Esther's feet and begging for mercy. He thinks that Haman's lost his mind and is molesting the queen. And just at that moment, I love all these just at that moment moments in Esther, they're brilliant. One of the king's servants happens to tell Xerxes that Haman had built a gallows for Mordecai. And so the king's response is immediate: hang him on it. And that's the end of Haman's story. So what should we learn from Haman and from his life? Well, the first and most important thing is that God was totally absent from Haman's life. Haman had made himself the center. Haman worshipped Haman. Nobody else mattered. Haman found his identity through status and power. And the more he had, the more he wanted. And ironically, he couldn't enjoy what he had because of his paranoia. His massive ego resulted in a totally distorted view of reality, which meant that he overreacted to anyone he thought might be an enemy. When he thought he was in control of his life, it was patently obvious he wasn't. When he thought he was invincible, it turned out he was really weak and cowardly. For all his delusions of grandeur, in the end, his life counted for nothing. Well, at this stage, you might be saying, well, I'm not like Haman, because God is in my life. But just where exactly is God in your life? Because when God's not at the center of our lives, we too are in danger of looking through a distorted lens. It's very easy for our lives to become all about us. We too can get sucked into chasing after significance and meaning in all the wrong places. And the desire for power and status and control is never far from us. We can get sucked into looking for meaning and significance in all the wrong places, and the desire for power and status and control is never far from us. And even Jesus' disciples fell into that trap. There's a bit in the Gospels where two of his disciples come to Jesus and ask if they can sit at his right and his left when he comes into his kingdom, i.e. they wanted the places of honour. And when the other disciples heard about it, Matthew 20:24, they were indignant. For why were they indignant? I wonder if it was because they felt if anyone deserved to sit on Jesus' right or his left, they did. And secretly, they probably were all wondering, what might we get as a result of following Jesus? What was Jesus' response? Matthew 20:25. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Just like Jesus, the disciples were to be the exact opposite of what the world expected. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Haman's status also derived from his great wealth. But Jesus warned his disciples not to place too much importance on what they owned. Luke 12:15, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And Luke 12:30, for the pagan world runs after all these things, and your Father knows that you need them. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. No matter what Haman had, it was never enough. And we too can get trapped in the same way, wanting the latest gadget, needing the latest upgrade, or whatever it is, and actually looking at people who have things that we don't have, whether it's material possessions or even spiritual giftings, and be dissatisfied. And so often when these ambitions are filled, other desires move in to take their place. And when I was preparing this, this thought came into my mind, and I thought, no, I'm not going to say this. I'm not going to put it in the sermon. And then tonight when we were worshipping, it came back, so I'm going to share it with you. But I happen to know somebody who, materially speaking, they're extremely well off. And they should be happy. But whatever they have, it's never enough. There's always something wrong. And it's almost as if they look at life, and instead of seeing everything that's right, it's like the thing they focus on is the thing that's wrong. And they can't be content with what they have. And I think that that's a bit of a message for us today, that we can be, if we're not keeping God at the centre, we get out of kilter with things. And so it's like our perspective on life gets warped and damaged. And that we can be people who, instead of seeing all the blessings that God has given us, or the things that have happened that God has done for us, all we can think of is, this is the one thing God hasn't done for me. This is the one thing God hasn't given to me. And actually, Haman was unable to be content. He had so much. He was the second chap in the kingdom. But he wasn't content. He had no contentment. He was completely, his peace was gone. And I think we're not second in the kingdom. You know, we're not kind of in that sort of situation. But I think wherever we are, we can still fall into the danger of not being able to be content with what we have, not even that we can't even see what we have because the lens has got a bit cloudy. We can't see how God has blessed us. We can't see what he's given us. We can't see the opportunities that he's opening to us. All we can see is, but this didn't work, or this hasn't happened. Or even we look at other people and we think, well, it's happened to them and it's worked for them, and why hasn't it happened for me? And then we stop trusting God and believing that God wants our best. We're citizens of heaven. That's where our significance lies. That's where our inheritance lies. And God has given us so many rich resources to use and to enjoy and to share and to bless people with. That's why it's great doing things like going out prayer walking, because you have the chance to bless people. It's great being able to help someone who's in need, not because it makes us worthy or better, but it's just we've got this to share with each other. And God gives us so many opportunities to show grace to people and to be kind to people, and we don't always see it. And we don't always do it, because so often our lives narrow down. I think that's what happens. Our lives narrow down to, it's all about me. It's all about what I have or I don't have. And then our lives are diminished. And God wants us to have wonderful, expansive lives. lives that are full of him, lives that are full of the riches of heaven, full of his grace. That's where our significance, identity, and status lie. So keep God at the centre. Cultivate a servant heart. Don't be greedy. We must learn to be content in any and every circumstance. St. Paul said, I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. So remember your inheritance. We're citizens of heaven, and let your life flow out of that, not out of a perceived lack or discontentment or envy or pride. Amen.